change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
Hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Enoor. Very interesting show today. I think we will be talking about the history of plutocracy here in the United States and how things changed and this country became more egalitarian, at least financially, and how it turned back to plutocracy. And hopefully we can learn something from that history about what we need to do next and how to rein in the power and the huge amounts of money that the very rich hold. My guest is Sam Pizzigatti. We'll be talking about The Rich Don't Always Win, the forgotten triumph over plutocracy that created the American middle class. Sam is a veteran labor journalist. He was on this show, I don't know, a year or a year and a half ago. He has written op-eds and articles on income and wealth that were published in a host of major American dailies, from the New York Times to the Miami Herald, and in magazines and journals. His book before this current one, Greed and Good, Understanding and Overcoming the Inequality That Limits Our Lives, won the outstanding title rating of the year choice rating from the American Library Association. And Sam, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Well, thank you. I welcome the opportunity.
So let's start by explaining, first of all, the title, The Rich Don't Always Win. And then if you can also describe for our listeners the illustration on the cover of your book and explain that, though I'm sure you did not illustrate it.
Right. Well, that illustration is the classic hierarchy of wealth and power in a society one of the illustrators for the book cover picked out, and I think it's very appropriate for this book. The book is about the theme, the rich don't always win, and I think that's a theme that's relevant today, because there's a sense of defeatism about in our culture that no matter what happens, the rich always seem to come out on top. In the fiscal cliff deal, for instance, that was just set, the rich will pay slightly more in taxes over the next few years, but average Americans got hit with the end of the Social Security tax cut. They got hit with even a greater, more meaningful tax increase. So I wanted to try to get across the idea in this book that, in fact, the rich don't always win. That in over the first half of the 20th century, average people in the United States actually took down plutocracy and created the first society in world history with a vibrant, thriving middle class that represented over half the population of the country.
Mm-hmm. I just want to go back for a second to that cover. You said that it shows, how did you put it?
The classic hierarchy of wealth and power.
So it's interesting to me. I'll just describe it quickly. In the bottom rung, there's workers, and there's several of them who are lying down dead, I'm assuming. And on top of that, there's the fat bosses who are busy eating and drinking. And then on top of that, there's the military, the police, etc. And then it's a little hard to see in the little illustration that. What's the next rung there?
Let me take a look at the cover.
Is that the
right now? The religious hierarchy.
That's what struck me as very interesting. I don't think that a lot of people would see the church as part of that. I do think it is, and I think it's interesting that You have it there. So let me ask you about that in a second. But let's see. What's on top of the church?
Well, the above that is aristocracy.
Aristocracy, and then...
And then a bag full of money.
So let's just, before we go to the meat of the book and really the message that we need to hear today about how things like that can change and how they have been changed, talk about the role of religion and the church in that pyramid of wealth.
Well, as I said, this was the classic hierarchy, referring to the classic period of history in modern history in Europe when the church hierarchy was very tied in with monarchy and the aristocracy. So we're talking as a visual representation, not so much for right now and today, but from that classic period.
Mm-hmm. Though I'll just a quick side note, and then we'll get back to your book. But I actually visited the Vatican and mm-hmm. was just astounded by the riches that are represented there. And then even more so when I learned that what's on display is really just the less valuable things. The rest of it is stored in their, protected vaults, etc. And when you think about how the church still collects money from poor people throughout the world, really, and the history of it, it's quite stunning. But anyway, that's not what your book is about. So let's get to it. Describe for us, if you will, please, America before the 20th century dawned. What was it like just before the 1900s?
After the Civil War, what we had in the United States was a very rapid industrialization of the country, the creation of a national market that started during the Civil War. And with that creation of a national market, with that industrialization, came an incredible concentration of wealth at the top of our society. Historians call that period the Gilded Age. In the 1890s, there was serious resistance to that concentration of income and wealth at the top of our society. Those were the years of the populist revolt. And farmers in the West and in the South united as never before to challenge plutocracy. They elected governors and senators and other members of Congress. They were really making inroads. But in the election of 1896, plutocracy got its act together and essentially crushed the populist rebellion. So by the time 1900 came around, plutocracy stood unchallenged. We had these phenomenal personal accumulations of grand fortune. At the same time, we had absolutely no income tax on the books and virtually no trade union presence to act as a check on the super wealthy. So we had this very, very well entrenched plutocracy much more dominant than our plutocracy today. Yet, 50 years later, just a half century later, the tables had been almost completely turned, and we had a society that revolved around our middle class. We went from a society that was two-thirds poor to a society that was two-thirds middle class, and that was a tremendous achievement.
Mm-hmm. And we'll want to talk about that, but if you can maybe describe for us what that time just before the 1900s rolled in, what did it look like for the majority of Americans? We see, for example, on Facebook nowadays quite a few photos of child laborers.
Yes.
Talk about, you know, if you and I lived there then, or here then, what would our life be like?
Well, if for most Americans back then, if we lived then, we would have lived in hovels. We would have lived in incredibly cramped apartments, stuffed with multiple families. We would have had our kids working in factories for long hours a day, or else all our family members in our apartments doing piecework for incredibly low wages. We would have had no access to medical care. It would have been impossible to take your kids in for a routine checkup. We would have had our breadwinners dying in industrial accidents on a regular basis, and we would have been living rather short lives, and we would have had our lives snuffed out frequently by all sorts of different diseases. It was a very, very rough time. Meanwhile, politically, we had a Senate of the United States where senators were not even elected by public vote. They were named by state legislatures, and that enabled it to be very easy for America's largest corporations to pick the senators they wanted to represent them. So we had journalists in Washington. They didn't talk about the senator from Ohio. They talked about the senator from Standard Oil. The distortion of our political process was just that obvious.
Mm-hmm. So, as you said, within 50 years or so, everything changed. How did that happen?
Well, it happened through a lot of sweat and sacrifice on the part of average Americans. But one thing that I think that was very critical to the success of the pushback was the strategic unity among people fighting for a decent society. And those people fighting for a decent society really crossed the political spectrum. You had progressive Republicans oriented around Teddy Roosevelt. You had progressive Democrats oriented around Louis Brandeis, who would later become a Supreme Court justice. You had a very, very active socialist party in the first half of the 20th century, and that socialist party was very strong in places like Milwaukee and New York City and Schenectady and other urban centers. And all these different people fighting for a decent society shared the same basic strategic outlook. And that was, they all agreed that if we were going to create a decent society, we had to do two things. We had to level up the bottom and level down the top. Unless we worked at both those things, we weren't going to make progress. So all these people differed tactically on how to go about that, but they shared the same basic strategic vision, and that vision was we had to go after the rich with the same passion that we fought to raise the wages and improve the working conditions of people at the bottom of society. And I think that vision, that double-barreled vision, helps explain the success that movement for a better America achieved.
Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking that perhaps this is the main obstacle we have to overcome today, is that strategic unity across the political spectrum, and even, you know, not among Republicans. It seems like we have a movement that is very encouraging in many ways. The Occupy movement, even the community radio movement, the farmers, organic farmers, etc., all over the place. But it seems to really be operating on the side, the sideway of the majority of Americans. It seems like at this point, most Americans do not yet understand what's going on and where it's going and what the implications are. And I mean, you know, I have this kind of visual in my head of people watching TV and suddenly everything falls down around them. You know, there's no more electricity, and that's when they suddenly wake up and it's too late. So what do you think?
Well, we don't have today among people who feel that they're striving for a decent society the same sort of strategic unity that we had in the first half of the 20th century. We have many people today who consider themselves reformers who say that we should concentrate on helping the poor and doing everything that we can to help the poor, and anything else is a distraction. So if we talk about the rich and their dominance in our society, that's a distraction from working to help the poor. And this sort of sense that we need to not be worrying about the rich has been part of our politics ever since the time of President John F. Kennedy. He said very famously, "A rising tide lifts all boats." And his idea was that if we just concentrated on economic growth and growing the economic pie, then everybody would have a bigger piece, and we wouldn't have to worry about how the pie is distributed, how fairly or unfairly the pie is distributed. So you had Kennedy talking about that. In the 1990s, you had Bill Clinton essentially taking very much the same stance. And his administration, again, ended up cutting taxes, cutting capital gains taxes for the very richest in our society. So I think our job one today, to me, is completing the mission that the Occupy movement started, and that is that the Occupy movement put the question starkly, 1% versus 99%. And I think that was a brilliant formulation. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to press and hold our politicians accountable as much as possible to that way of looking at our problems.
My guest is Sam Pizzigatti. His latest book that we're talking about, new book, The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. He's a veteran labor writer, and, well, we're talking about the history of plutocracy and putting it down and it coming right back. So, Sam, you made the point that Democratic presidents have been just as invested in the return of plutocracy as the Republican ones, maybe not quite as vigorously as the Republicans are right now, but they've all basically been working for the same ends and for the same class. Let's understand from the history again how things like that can change. So what made it so that in the 1900s and you know the 50 years that that came after that, what was it? What message were people responding to? How come that so many people from so many different walks of life and so many different ideologies all got together and said, this is not right, this is not good, and there are better ways to do it, and here is how, and they succeeded within a really short time when you look at things historically. What was it? What can we learn from those times?
Well, I think we can learn that they had some very specific goals. They set about creating institutions that would help make the United States a more equal place, that would help trim the plutocracy down to democratic size. And they concentrated most of their effort on building two specific institutions. One was a system of progressive taxation with steeply graduated tax rates, and the other was the creation of a strong, vibrant labor movement in the United States. And those two institutions, the steeply progressive progressive federal tax system and the labor movement, became the bulwarks of equality in mid-20th century America. Their success at creating those two institutions essentially turned the nation around, created a middle-class society. What we've seen over the last 30 years is that both these two institutions, the progressive income tax progressive tax system, and the labor movement, both these foundation blocks have been toppled over.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about it. Explain first the graduated progressive tax system. If you can both explain how it worked and also how were they successful in implementing something like that, which is really quite amazing.
Well, at the beginning of the 20th century, there was no federal income tax at all. The federal government took in most of its revenue from tariffs on foreign goods, which essentially put the tax burden on average working families, and from excise taxes on things like alcohol, which also put the tax burden on average working family. So reformers back then and egalitarians back then fought very hard for a progressive income tax. And indeed, almost to the day, a century ago in 1913, they finally succeeded in ratifying to the Constitution an amendment that gave Congress the green light to establish a federal income tax. And later in 1913, we had the first federal income tax. Now, that first tax was not nearly as progressive as progressives of the day wanted. It set under that first income tax, the rates only went up to 7%. So, in other words, a millionaire back in 1913 didn't have to pay more than 7% of any dollar of income that he made in federal income tax. But progressives kept pressing, and when World War I came and the federal government desperately needed more revenue, progressives demanded a 100% tax rate on income over $50,000. There was a nationwide campaign backed by labor unions, backed by progressive Republicans and Democrats to win this 100% income cap, essentially. They didn't get their way, but they did get that top rate by the end of World War I, all the way up to 77%. So the rate went from 7% in 1913, the top rate, to 77% in 1918. After the war, we had a tremendous right-wing reaction, which destroyed the reform movement in the United States, terribly weakened the emerging labor movement, and the 1920s were a time of plutocratic restoration. Then we had the Depression starting in 1929, and the table started turning again. And once again, Americans demanded higher taxes on the rich. In 1935, Senator Huey Long from Louisiana spearheaded what was called the Share Our Wealth movement, and he again demanded a 100% tax rate on income over $1 million in his case. And by the time of World War II, those forces pushing for a 100% top rate even included a president of the United States. Mm. In 1942, Franklin Roosevelt called for a 100% tax on income over $25,000. And again, this movement didn't fully succeed, but by the end of World War II, the top tax rate on income over $200,000 stood at 94%. So this constant pressure from the base, from average Americans, by the middle of the 20th century, created a really steeply graduated, deeply progressive tax system.
Mm-hmm. And nowadays, of course, we're told incessantly that if you tax the rich, the economy will suffer. Looking at the historic record, just how true is that?
Well, it's absolutely not true at all. That 94% tax rate on income over $200,000 that came in during World War II, the tax rate hovered around 90% on income over $200,000 for the next 20 years. So in other words, we had a high tax on the rich system in place for a generation. And that generation turned out to be the most prosperous quarter century for the middle class in the history of the United States. High taxes and rising on the rich and rising standard of living for working families went hand in hand throughout the late 1940s, the 1950s, and into the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I often, Sam, get to the what can we do at the last few minutes of the show, and we don't get to talk about that enough. So let me ask you right away. You have a suggestion on what we can press for regarding taxes nowadays. Let's hear that now. What do you think can and should be done to level wealth from I don't remember how you put it earlier, the below and the above or something like that, but to make the rich pay more and be a little less rich? What can we do tax-wise?
Well, we can do a number of different things. I don't think we need to just repeat exactly what we did in the past, but I think we need to learn from what we did in the past. So for instance, one thing we could do, our government at the federal level and state level and the local level, all our governments spend a fortune in contracts that they let to private corporations to provide various goods and services. We should not let any federal contracts to corporations that pay their top executives over 25 or 50 times what they pay their lowest paid workers. In the United States today, corporations typically are paying their top executives 400 and 500 times more than their lowest paid workers. If we leverage the power of the public purse against this sort of corporate greed, we can make a sizable difference in inequality in the United States. We could also try to return to Eisenhower-era tax rates when we had a 91% top tax rate on high incomes. And I would say let's tie the threshold point for that top maximum tax rate to our minimum wage. So if a minimum wage worker can work all year as a minimum wage worker currently can and only make around $10,000, if we set a tax rate of 91% on income over 25 times the minimum wage, that would mean that all income over $250,000 would face a 91% tax rate. If we put that 25% times multiple in effect, our very richest would have a vested interest in raising the minimum wage, because the higher the minimum wage went, the higher the threshold would be before the 91% top tax rate would go into effect. So in other words, I think there are very specific steps that we could take today to level down our plutocracy that is weighing down so heavily upon us.
Mm-hmm. And I love that idea of tying the tax to the minimum wage, and we'll get back to that. We do have a first caller for you, Sam. 256-2011-866-899-WORT. If you haven't called in the past 7 days. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
My question is the change in the media since the Eisenhower era and how that played, and also how taxes became for the working class, labor class, a negative. They view taxes, as something very negative, even if it's in any sense, because they always think it'll either trickle down to them or that it's never good. Taxes are considered bad. They're not viewed as a good for the community.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Sam.
Yes, good questions. Well, media concentration has most definitely become a dangerous fact of life since the middle of the 20th century. We have a far smaller number of corporations controlling our media today than we had back in the Eisenhower years, and that's definitely not good for democratic discourse. One of the things that my book points out, by the way, is that back in the early 1900s, the largest circulation weekly publication in the United States was a socialist publication. It was called The Appeal to Reason. It was published out of Girard, Kansas, and it had the largest circulation of any weekly publication in the United States. So we look back on that, and I think we can only marvel at how different our media landscape is today than it was in years past. On the caller's point about working people today being very, very anti-tax, I mean that's understandable because the way the tax burden is set up today, working families sacrifice more at tax time than the rich do. Back in the 1950s, that was different. It was different. Working people saw that that the richest among us were having to sacrifice at tax time too, and that created a climate where people willingly paid taxes and supported the programs, the government social programs that can help all of us.
Mm-hmm. I want to just get back briefly to the media point. Because I, when I wait in line in the supermarket, of course I look at these magazines that tell me all I don't need to know about the lives of the extremely rich. Some of them I don't even know who they are because I don't watch TV. But again, when I travel, if I'm in a hotel room or whatever, and I do try to watch the news, so-called, I end up getting the same kind of diet. And it occurs to me that all these media are owned by extremely rich people, and what they provide is, first of all, the circus part of bread and circus. And that keeps the attention of really a lot of people there on the circus and not on reality. But also, it seems to strengthen that American notion that this can happen to me too, that I can also be rich and I also want to be rich and I also want to have these incredible mansions and 15 of them and so on and so forth. What do you think about that?
I think that's very right, and the media fixation on the lifestyles of the rich and famous, which was the title of one famous TV show a little while back, that also helps create a sense of, I think, despondency among average people.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not rich, then I'm not worthy. If I don't have a lot of money, there must be something wrong with me. And those are very demobilizing attitudes to have, and attitudes that help perpetuate our incredible maldistribution of income and wealth in the United States.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple more callers for you, so let's get back to the phones. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
One hardly knows where to begin, and in these discussions, the one point that's never made and paid any attention to is the fact that what we have are corporate unions. We've been operating on the AFL-CIO's fake industrialism, the brotherhood of labor and capital, and have forsaken the basic premise that the owning class and the working class have exactly opposite goals. The reason the labor movement started in the first place was because they were able to articulate the fact that the the goals of workers and capital are completely opposite. For instance, take a state like Wisconsin. This is not an issue in either political party. Child poverty ranges between 12 and 17, sometimes nearly 20%. In a state that produces food, it's not a political issue. In Milwaukee, Milwaukee is the fourth poorest city in the United States. Child poverty in Milwaukee County is 60%. It is not a political issue. The labor unions won't touch it. Now, this is the problem. We don't deal with basic issues. Literacy is dropping in the cities, in the quasi-socialist revolutions, the Bolivarian Revolution in South America, that Hugo Chavez made it issue number one, because you can't have an active, educated electorate or unions without people that can read and write. Mm-hmm. The schools don't do it. It's not an issue. We don't deal with basic things. The union movement has been complicit in its own destruction. Take the case of Walker and the symbolic protests that took place. We had 200,000 people surrounded the Capitol, everybody moving in the right direction. And if they had called a general strike, which the unions wouldn't even articulate the words, we would have driven Walker out of office. He would have resigned. Instead, they took all this potentially revolutionary working class energy, funneled it into the electoral politics, which the banks and insurance companies own both sides of, and it disappeared. Mm-hmm. We learn nothing from this.
Yeah. Okay, caller, thanks very much. Very eloquent argument. However, he started by saying that no one talks about it, and Sam actually does talk about the unions in his book. So, Sam, if you like, why don't we make it a larger discussion? Why don't you start first by talking about the importance of the labor unions when they started, and then you can respond to our caller's point about what they became and who they became, and, you know, maybe we have a vision for the future of labor unions, too.
Well, the rise of the labor movement over the first half of the 20th century was absolutely essential to the creation of the mass middle class United States, to the much more equal United States of the mid-1950s. That labor movement became an appreciable check on corporate behavior in both the economic and the political realms. That said, the caller is quite correct that that various interludes, many top labor leaders in the United States have played not a helpful role. So, for instance, the book talks about how in 1963, when Kennedy proposed a steep tax cut on the very richest Americans, AFL-CIO President George Meany essentially signaled to Congress that labor would not oppose that move, which was just a terrible mistake, and the Kennedy tax cut opened the door to the Reagan tax cuts for the rich that followed 20 years later. But by the same token, in World War II, when the tax rate on the rich really went up all the way went up very high, all the way up to 94%. The CIO unions, the United Auto Workers, and other CIO unions were absolutely essential to that battle to raise the top tax rates on the rich. We need that same sort of CIO spirit today, and I think our top labor leaders today are much more in tune with that CIO spirit than they are with that ethos that George Meany showed in the 1960s and 1970s.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think the labor unions, especially in places like Wisconsin and really about half of the states in the United States, where the unions have been emasculated, what needs to be done now? And I just want to add to what the caller was saying and what also you discuss in your book, that I think the unions have been feeling so safe in their place that it's true that the leaders have become fat cats who make a lot of money and drive Cadillacs and dine and wine in expensive hotels and restaurants. Here in Wisconsin, before Walker, the unions were making all kinds of really ugly moves to try and force people who wanted to create their own unions, but instead of helping them to do that, they were trying to force people to join unions that were really inappropriate for the kind of work that they were doing, and thus really did not earn much sympathy from people who then maybe, I don't know, maybe went and voted for Walker because of that. What kind of vision do we need to have for labor unions to become really representative of the needs of the majority of people, of working people?
Well, I don't know the specific details of the situation on the ground.
Right, but it probably represents, you know,
comment on that. But I think what the labor movement needs is a vision of itself as a movement for all working people, and not as a you know, a narrow trade union representing a narrow group of workers. The broader the vision that unions have, the more they see themselves as a labor movement and not a trade union movement, the better it is for unions, and the better it is for society as a whole. And indeed, in the middle of the 20th century, particularly in the 1940s, the labor movement had that sense that it was fighting for all working people, that it was leading the charge for a decent society, and it was able to help create, by many yardsticks, that decency for Americans. And I don't see there's any reason why the labor movement can't do that again. All that being said, I think we need to recognize that even a lousy labor union is better than not having a union in place at all. Mm-hmm. And right now, we don't have labor unions in place at all. The new Labor Department statistics that just came out last week say that only 6.6% of private sector workers in the United States now carry labor cards. What that essentially means is that across vast swatches of the private sector in the United States today, there is absolutely no union presence. Mm-hmm. And that is a sad commentary on where we are, and that's a major reason why wealth and income in this country have concentrated so viciously, so stunningly at the summit of our economy.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to explore it more, but we do have more callers on the line, so let's get back to the phones. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
I wanted to talk about our antitrust laws, whether they've been enforced at all over the last 30 to 45 years, whether they even still exist. You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt, and he was known as leading the trust-busting charge way back in, before 1920. And when we see what's going on in other countries, your suggestions are absolutely really great ones. But the problem is, what's going on in this country with this huge disparity between the rich and the poor is going on all over the world. the same slogans are being used in all these countries. The people of Greece are being asked to absorb the crimes of their and the international banking system. You know, it just seems without antitrust. I mean, that's one thing anyway. When outfits are too big to fail, too rich to fail, people have absolutely no power against them, and we haven't had politicians who are willing to enforce our antitrust laws for the last 45 or 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Sam?
Yes, the antitrust regulations, the anti-monopoly regulations in the United States have essentially gone mostly unenforced for the past 30 to 40 years. There have been some giant corporate mergers stopped, but they've those efforts to control monopoly have been very few and far between. So we have a situation now where almost all major industries are dominated by just a small handful of companies. Antitrust laws were much more vigorously prosecuted in the middle of the 20th century. It's interesting that at the beginning of the 20th century, how we should deal with corporate behemoths was a topic of great discussion and division among progressive people. So you had, by 1912, you had people like Louis Brandeis saying that we needed to break up all the big corporations, that big was always bad. And then you had people like Teddy Roosevelt, whose ideas evolved on this, who had a reputation as a trust buster, but eventually came to believe that in modern capitalism, we were always going to have big corporations. So what we had to do was regulate those corporations very tightly. And then we had the socialist position of Eugene Debs, where he said that Roosevelt was right, that in modern capitalism we were going to have huge corporations, but Debs said there's no way we can effectively regulate them. We had to control them. We had to make them state enterprises. So that's been a dialogue and discussion that has a long history within the U.S. progressive movement.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it is something that we can get reinstated?
Yeah, I think that should be a prime topic of the discussion. We need that sort of vigorous debate that Brandeis and Roosevelt and Debs had 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Thank you. To kind of pull together a couple of subjects that a number of callers have already mentioned, in consecutive recent years, we've seen poverty rise, something that hasn't happened for, you know, many years running since the Great Depression. We have wealth disparity that is greater than any other industrialized country, and now greater than a lot of, you know, developing countries. In discussions in recent years with an historian friend of mine, he constantly reminds me that when you have really great wealth disparity in a society, a situation is simply not sustainable. It leads to less and less cohesion. And I'm wondering if your guest would care to comment on that, if he discusses the fact that this is not, you know, leads to an unstable society, if he discusses that in his book.
Yeah, he certainly does. Thank you. Sam.
Yes, the caller makes some excellent points, and the book does talk about that. We have 20 years of scholarship about what our growing inequality means for society, and that scholarship has been led by epidemiologists. Those are the scientists who study the health of populations, and what these epidemiologists have shown is that there is a very, very tight direct link between life expectancy and the level of inequality in a nation and a society, that the wider the gap between the rich and everybody else, the shorter the lives that everybody in those societies live, not just very poorest people, but middle-income people and affluent people. as well. And when you ask them, well, what's the reason for this? Epidemiologists like Dr. Richard Wilkinson from the UK say that the more inequality in a society, the more tension in a society, the more stress in a society, and that stress essentially pounds on a daily basis, pounds our immune systems, and leaves us weaker and more susceptible to all sorts of disease. Hence, we live shorter lives. And so the United States today, despite spending more on medical care than any other nation in the world, far more than any other nation in the world, the United States has the lowest life expectancy of any major developed nation on the face of the earth today. That's inequality, and that's why we need to fight inequality, fight plutocracy.
Mm-hmm. So going back to that idea of tying tax to minimum wage, besides, you know, the ingenuity of it, I love it because it, by default, would lead to something else that you discuss in the book, which is cultures of solidarity, which I think the point that you just made also talks about that. So how can we create, well, first of all, maybe you want to explain what that means, but how do we help create more of that culture of solidarity in this country where the mighty dollar is it? There's nothing that seems to be more important to the majority of Americans, and because they are so attached to it, they don't see how it's really it's killing them and their own children and the planet that they live on, etc.
Right. Well, a solidarity economy is economy where all prosper at the same time, and that no one prospers unless everyone essentially prospers, unless everyone gets ahead. We have the opposite in the United States today of a solidarity economy. We have an economy where top corporate executives can outsource and downsize and slash pension benefits and raise their own compensation at the same time. So the more the rich exploit the poor, the richer the rich get. We need to put in place economic mechanisms that change that incentive system. One of the things is what we talked about before, tying the top tax rate to the minimum wage, giving the richest among us a vested personal interest in advancing and enhancing the well-being of the poorest and weakest among us. And I think we can do that in a number of different areas and create in the process a real solidarity economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining us today. Sam Pizzigatti, a longtime labor reporter. We've been talking about his new book, The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class.
Keep up to date on the issues we've been talking about. We do a weekly newsletter called Too Much that covers inequality and the fight against it. And people just Google Too Much, you'll find the newsletter.
Yes. Thank you so very much. The guys are here. Let me cough and then I'll come back and thank you. Thank the people I need to thank. And thank you for listening and calling in. We'll be back again next week. I'm Esti Dinur. Bye-bye.